The legacy of Ruth Bader Ginsburg and the future of the U.S. Supreme Court. This morning, close friends, family members, staff, and colleagues held a private ceremony for Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg inside the U.S. Supreme Court building. And right now, her coffin sits on the portico of the building so that members of the public can pay their respects. Justice Ginsburg was inarguably one of the most important Americans of the past century, admired as a pioneering women's rights attorney, a towering liberal intellectual on the bench, and as the notorious RBG late in life, inspiring millions. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Now, as the nation mourns RBG, Washington gears up for an historic fight over who will succeed her on the Supreme Court. What happens now? That's Maine Calling, next. But first, this news update. For Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. The death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg leaves a Supreme Court vacancy and the loss of a woman who was revered by so many. Today, we'll look back at her life and legacy and ahead to the looming battle to fill the seat she held. Joining me, Maren Sorensen, who is an assistant professor of government at Bowdoin College, and Jean Cummings, deputy Washington Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal. As always, we want to hear from you. What do you feel Justice Ginsburg is her most notable contributions were? What questions do you have about the future of her Supreme Court seat? You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. We'll talk with Jean and Maren in just a moment, but joining us now from Washington, D.C., U.S. Senator Angus King. Senator King, welcome back, and thanks for taking a few minutes to join us.
Jennifer, delighted to be with you as always.
What do you think will be the legacy of Justice Ginsburg?
Well, I'm very hesitant to venture on that because of the distinguished two other guests that you have who really have a depth of knowledge. But I think her legacy is empowerment. She really empowered a generation. And, you know, she went where women weren't supposed to go. The dean at Harvard Law School said, "Why are you here taking a slot away from a man?" And she really fought all her life for equality. And I think her best epitaph is already chiseled above the door of the Supreme Court. I walked over there the night of her death and looked up, and it says equal justice under law. And I think that's about as good a summary of her career as anybody could make up. Equal justice under law. She made that real for millions and millions of people in this country.
You have stated that hearings and a vote to fill the seat Justice Ginsburg held should not happen until after the election. It looks like that's not Mitch McConnell's plan. Can the Senate Republicans be stopped?
I don't think there are any parliamentary tricks or techniques or stamping of the feet that will be able to change the course that Mitch McConnell's on. The only thing that will stop it would be an attack of conscience by four Republican senators. It's really important, I think. I always like to try to look at the history. If you go back throughout American history, there have been 13 vacancies in the Supreme Court in the last 10 months of an election year. There were nine before July 1st that occurred before July 1st of an election year. All of those were confirmed except Merrick Garland, who Mitch McConnell, as we all know, said we shouldn't vote on this because it's an election year. He said that in February. There have been four after July 1st. Three, the presidents refused to nominate somebody because it was so close to the election. Two of those presidents, by the way, are Lincoln and Eisenhower. And then one was tabled. So there's never been a Supreme Court justice confirmed this close to an election. It's really is a slight an insult, I think, to the American people. I mean, I was here during Merrick Garland. I just couldn't believe it. They went, you know, through a whole year, and wouldn't even give him a hearing. Mitch McConnell wouldn't even meet with him in his office. And now they're saying, oh, no, we've got to confirm this person 5-6 weeks before before the American people have an opportunity to speak. So I just there ought to be a word for hypocrisy that times 10. I mean, it's shocking to me.
Senator King, you were on CNN yesterday talking about your concerns for the future of the Affordable Care Act, which could come before the Supreme Court this term, which begins October 5th. What do you believe is likely to happen? And if the Supreme Court were to rule that the Affordable Care Act is unconstitutional, is there something that Congress could do, given, say, a Democratic Congress, to keep it the law of the land?
Well, let me correct one thing you said. You said it could come before. It will come before. The argument on the Texas petition to totally repeal the Affordable Care Act is scheduled for November 10th, 1 week after the election. So that's going to happen. The Trump administration, by the way, is supporting that lawsuit to completely not gut or nick, but to eliminate the Affordable Care Act. Here's the reality on the court. Before we lost Justice Ginsburg, it was a 5-4 court with Justice Roberts really emerging as a kind of swing vote. He could have gone back and forth. If the new nominee, and by the way, I think it's kind of interesting that a lot of my Republican colleagues have announced they're going to vote for this nominee before they even know who it is. But anyway, if the new nominee is a very, very conservative justice in the mold of Kavanaugh and Gorsuch, it's then a 6-3 court, and Roberts can't be a swing vote even if he wanted to. So the stakes are very high, and the stakes are high with the Affordable Care Act. I went back and looked at the numbers. There are over 150,000 people in Maine who have insurance through the Affordable Care Act, either on the exchange or through Maine Care. There's another half the population of Maine, Jennifer, have what would be considered pre-existing conditions, which will go if the Affordable Care Act goes. All this political talk, the president says, I'm going to protect pre-existing conditions. He has no plan to do so. And it's in the Affordable Care Act. That's where it came from, the protection of pre-existing conditions. And it will go if the Supreme Court strikes it down. And so far in 10 years, there has not been a credible alternative put forward that involves the protection of pre-existing conditions. So the stakes couldn't be higher just in that one area. There may be other areas, but that's one that I think everybody should be very clear on. If the Affordable Care Act is gone, protection for pre-existing conditions will be gone. And by the way, having had COVID will probably be called a pre-existing condition.
Mm. If the seat is filled before the election, what do you think that means for the already hyper-partisan atmosphere in Washington and around the nation?
Well, it's certainly not going to help. You can always go back in history and say, well, the Republicans started it or the Democrats started. But at some point, somebody's got to stand up and say enough is enough. We've really got to try to return to some respect and for precedent and for the way these things have been handled, instead of just trying to jam things because you have a majority. If four Republicans said tomorrow, we're not going to vote on this, and two already have, Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, if two more said that, this whole thing would go away. We could move forward, it may be the same president, it may be a new president, and we could get out of this crisis that's being artificially created by this rush. And by the way, I know I'm talking too much, but it really bugs me that Mitch McConnell didn't do anything about COVID relief for 4 months, and within 2 hours of Justice Ginsburg's passing, was talking about scheduling a vote in the U.S. Senate. I just find that really offensive.
Senator King, thank you so much for calling in. Senator Angus King calling in from Washington today. Turning to you, Maren Sorensen, Justice Ginsburg, before she became a Supreme Court justice, was a famous civil rights attorney. Her cases that made her famous were arguing for women's rights, six before the Supreme Court. But it's more than just the rights that she won for women, but also that she was the architect of the whole strategy, right?
Yeah, so she was a co-founder of the Women's Rights Project, which was part of the ACLU, and she served as general counsel from 1973 to 1980. And part of their strategy, a large part of the strategy that they adopted, was to early on select cases to bring where the man had been the injured party. So although the first brief that she filed was in Reed versus Reed, and that was a case, so she filed a brief as an amicus, that case didn't have the man as the injured party. The first case that she argued did have that man as the injured party. And I want to say three of the six cases she brought to the Supreme Court, the man was the injured party. I'll check to make sure that that's right. But certainly the first case, Frontario v. Richardson, it was a case that dealt with spousal benefits in the armed forces, where if the female was the spouse, the female automatically was entitled to spousal benefits from the military. But if the male was the spouse, the male was not automatically entitled to benefits. And so she brought that as a case on sex discrimination, where the man was the discriminated against party and won that case. So, yeah, that was part of the architecture, was, you know, recognizing that she was going to be arguing in front of nine men on the Supreme Court, and that it's maybe easier to hear and digest a message when the discrimination is happening to your own sex. And then from there, build a basis for law where she could start bringing cases where women were being discriminated against.
More recently, Maren, she was in the minority on the Supreme Court and was well known for her dissents. She put a lot of care into those dissents. I understand the reason is because she saw them perhaps being useful to Supreme Court justices in the future.
Yeah, and she would say that the dissenter writes for the future. Oh, in addition to a precedent, a dissent being useful for future court precedent, a dissent can also be instructive to Congress, for example. So she dissented in Ledbetter v. Goodyear Tire, which had to do with unequal pay for women. And her dissent was sort of an instruction manual for how Congress could amend Title VII to make future claims possible for women who had experienced pay disparities.
All right. I want to bring you into the conversation, Jean Cummings. Why don't we start with the timeline? President Trump has said that he will likely nominate, or at least others have said that he'll likely nominate a replacement on Saturday. What then? What do you expect to come after that?
Well, we would expect then for Senator McConnell and Senator Lindsey Graham, who's the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, to immediately schedule hearings. And it's unlikely the president, you know, will surprise anyone with his nominee. But there is due diligence that has to be done. Secret Service has to do background checks. There are just certain paces, steps that one that the Senate has to go through. But they can move relatively quickly. In the Kavanaugh case, it was going to be a one-day hearing, and then it turned into a two-day hearing. And that was a highly controversial case. It's unclear how controversial this one might become. Democrats don't like the process, but so far they haven't really started attacking the potential nominees. And so we don't know how contentious that part of it might become before we move forward. And then, you know, the Senate would move to a full vote. And the one thing that I think is probably the only last thing that Democrats might cling to is that while senators have said they think the vote should go forward, not all of them have said definitively they're going to back the nominee. So Lindsey Graham has said he has the votes on the Judiciary Committee. So this nomination will not be stopped there. It'll get to the floor.
Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, has said she has arrows in her quiver. What are those?
Well, I don't know exactly what she is referring to, but there has been there's been some speculation that the House could take action that would force the Senate to divert its attention. That, I mean, this is kind of crazy stuff, all right? But impeaching Bob Barr, impeaching the president again, could force the Senate to turn its attention to that matter and eat time. This is pretty wild speculation, but I suppose it could be counted as a quiver. And I don't know if she has other legislative tactics like that that she could do in the House to force the Senate to turn its eye away and use valuable days and, you know, perhaps a week focused on something different.
All right. Maren, I want to ask you about some of the nominees. I want to ask both you and Jean. The names that are floating to the top, from what I understand, from what the Wall Street Journal, Jean, is telling me, Amy Coney Barrett and Barbara Lagoa. What do we know about these two judges, Maren?
We certainly know more judicially about Amy Coney Barrett because she has served longer on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. She clerked for Scalia. She's quite young. I believe she's 48. In her confirmation hearing for her circuit court seat, she sort of self-described as a devout Roman Catholic, but also when pressed, stated very clearly that she separates her religion and that she would not impose her religious convictions upon the law. However, while she has not heard an abortion case directly, she did sign a dissent. She and two other justices had sought for what's called en banc review or full review, that the entire circuit would hear a case that dealt with an Indiana law that would have required for burial of remains, fetal remains or miscarriage remains. The three-judge panel on the circuit court struck that law as unconstitutional, and she and two others pushed for an en banc review. They were denied, and in that dissent that she signed on to, those three made pretty clear that they believed that the law was, in fact, constitutional. So that's something that's kind of being clung to, and she overwhelmingly seems to be appealing to the conservative base, the religious right. Barbara Lagoa is from Florida. She came from the Florida Supreme Court. She's now on the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, which covers Florida, and she's Cuban American. And so her potential nomination is being looked at possibly shoring up Florida electorally. However, we know less about her because she's only been on the Circuit Court of Appeals for a very short amount of time, and she didn't deal with some of these hot-button issues such as Roe v. Wade or abortion question on the Florida Supreme Court. However, what we do know from her confirmation hearing for that Circuit Court seat was that she did describe Roe as settled law and said that she would, quote, faithfully follow it, but hasn't otherwise dealt with the abortion question as a judge.
All right. And Jean, are any other names in what you're hearing floating to the level of those two?
Not really. They're, you know, the president has said he has five people on the list, but, you know, you just don't hear of the other three having, you know, a cheerleading squad behind them. So they don't have the same kind of advocacy level. And Amy Barrett, Mitch McConnell has told the president that she's the one that senators are most familiar with because they've, you know, she's been through the process, as Maren said, longer. She was the runner-up to Kavanaugh. And so some of them have met with her. So she's, as Maren said, much better known. The Florida judges has got influential people behind her, though, because of the presidential campaign. If Trump has already been aware that he has lost some ground with Latina voters in Florida, this would be a way that he could do that, but she is unknown. It's unclear how conservative she is, given that at the very beginning of her career, she was tapped by Jeb Bush. So it's her background and her how far she leans to the right hasn't been tested by way of court cases and that sort of thing.
All right. Well, we're talking about Ruth Bader Ginsburg and her legacy and what might come next for the Supreme Court. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post a comment on our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Bristol Seafood's North Atlantic Shrimp, caught in the wild and available ready to eat in the freezer at your local Hannaford. The Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association presenting the Common Ground Country Fair online. Details at fair.mofca.org. And Houston & Company, celebrating over 30 years of fine furniture making. Showroom and workshop in Kennebunkport and online at houstonandcompany.com.
America, are we ready for this election? This is Brian Lehrer from WNYC. Join me, my guests, and listeners from around the country for a live conversation about race and the election. Is racial justice possible in America? Can we agree on how to move toward greater equity? The election is coming soon, so America, now's the time to talk about race.
And that's coming up tonight at 8 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Generation Z is known for taking to the streets, but not always for showing up in large numbers to vote. Some young people, like Tyler OKK, think that lowering the voting age to 16 could help change that.
I think pairing both our civic and outdoor advocacy and grassroots advocacy with the ballot is important to making sure that our action is coordinated and on all fronts.
That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And that's coming up today at 4 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the life and legacy of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and what might be next for the Supreme Court and the nation. Joining me, Gene Cummings, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for The Wall Street Journal, and Maren Sorensen, Assistant Professor of Government at Bowdoin College. We invite you to be part of the conversation. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Calling us now, Mary Bonato, who's a Civil Rights Project Director at GLBTQ Legal Advocates and Defenders, or GLAAD. She's been there since 1990. Mary Bonato, in 2015, successfully argued before the U.S. Supreme Court in the historic case Obergefell versus Hodges, establishing the freedom to marry for same-sex couples nationwide. Mary, welcome back, and thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you, Jennifer.
What was it like to argue before Ruth Bader Ginsburg?
Well, the whole experience was amazing, exhilarating, terrifying. And then I barely made it to the court on time for the required 9 a.m. briefing because my cabbie got lost along the way.
Oh, my goodness.
Tried to drop me off at the wrong place, and I had to run to the court. But anyway, it was great. And actually, Justice Ginsburg asked the first question. I was first up. I had question one, the marriage question. And she asked me, you know, essentially where marriage regulations are defined by states, why should the federal courts be involved in this at all? And, you know, it was a softball because the answer is pretty simple, which is any law, any state law, is subject to constitutional guarantees like liberty and individuals choose who they're going to marry, not government, and equality, which is what justifies this categorical exclusion on same-sex couples marrying.
Wow. As a civil rights attorney, what did Justice Ginsburg mean to you? What lessons have you learned from how she lived her life?
Well, you know, one thing I'll say is she had a great sense of humor, and I just have to mention one other argument briefly about that, which is in the oral argument on the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, which basically said if you're legally married in a state but you're married to a person of the same sex, then you're going to be denied all federal-related protections and responsibilities. And she referred to those as skim milk marriages, which got everybody laughing in the courtroom. But more seriously, I think she really does have, she has made a difference to me, because she is somebody who clearly, no one can doubt her commitment over time to what she views as a more just and equal society for all people. You know, she referred to we the people a lot. And the thing is, one of the things that really marks her is that she understands that there is really no durable progress unless you persuade people to come to see things the way you do or come to agreement. And so even as a 13-year-old in 1946, I'm not sure if this has already been stated on the show, but I find it very moving. You know, for her synagogue's newspaper, she wrote a letter and she acknowledged the enormous harms, you know, imposed by the Nazis in the concentration camps and the enormous amount of healing that had to occur. But her message was, don't become victims of hate and prejudice yourselves because of this, and that we will not all be safe and free until we can heal these fractures and fraying of our, you know, of our community. And she's somebody who I think very famously had vigorous debates with, you know, ideological opposites, but Justice Scalia being one of them, but maintained friendships. And all through her life, she's cared about persuasion. Even when she became a great dissenter on the court, which she did, she understood she was speaking to future generations and that arguments that may not carry the day now hopefully are right, and hopefully do persuade people over time. And one of her clear visions in thinking about the Constitution was, you know, the 14th Amendment, 1868, part of, you know, one of the Reconstruction Amendments after the Civil War, contains this equal protection guarantee for all persons, you know, living in any state. And when she comes on the scene as a lawyer, that has never once been interpreted, the 14th Amendment has never once been interpreted to apply to the very customary distinctions governments made between men and women, disadvantaging men, disadvantaging women, whatever it might be. And she took out of that junk heap the Constitution and showed why it mattered and had to not only strike at distinctions based on sex, but on sexual orientation and gender identity, and, you know, clearly was a real advocate on making sure it fulfilled its original purposes around race. And, you know, she was really there for everyone and really committed to the whole we the people.
Mm. You've seen some of the names being floated by President Trump as a possible Supreme Court nominee. If confirmed, the court would be considered a 6-3 court. Might that threaten the gains made by the LGBTQ community?
Well, you know, on the 6-3 court piece, I mean, let me just say this. Of course, like any time you have a new Supreme Court appointment, you know, everybody's hackles go up, everybody's concerned, and I'm no exception in that regard. But I do want to take a deep breath about this because, for example, as we saw from some recent opinions in this just most recent term with, for example, Justice Gorsuch and Chief Justice Roberts siding with LGBTQ people on the reach of federal sex discrimination protections to protect people on jobs and actually in many other areas as well, you can't always prejudge things. And, you know, in addition, you know, some people have pointed to the role of religion in public life and that that's something that the court has really been redefining for more than two decades now, but especially in the last 15 years. And, you know, LGBTQ people are caught up in that, but those principles apply more broadly, even to the point of, you know, in some instances there are cases percolating up where one religious group wants to discriminate against people from another religious group. So I want to say that I think the court knows it has to tread pretty carefully, and that whatever rules it would apply to LGBTQ people, in many instances, maybe not all, are going to apply more broadly. I'd like to think that race would be walled off, but of course there are going to be people who would try that. You know, and then people say, oh, what does this mean for marriage? And, you know, I say that the marriage ruling is based on firm law. There's not only no reason to overturn it, you know, others have also talked about it as settled law. But I, you know, from day one, there have been efforts to cut into the marriage ruling to try to create second-class marriages by providing different benefits. You know, there are examples of that going on now. So I sort of feel like we just don't exactly know how people will line up. And a lot of these enterprises that are underway have been underway for some period of time. And in the end, I just don't want us, speaking to the persuasion point, I just don't want us to forget that, important as the court is, that there are other really huge issues going on right now, such as the pandemic, and making sure people are safe and healthy, and jobs, and, you know, the Affordable Care Act, whether that will remain, because right now there's, you know, a case that the court is to hear that would, you know, contribute to the dismantling of it even further with no replacement. So there's a lot of big issues for all of us to be focused on here, and the court is one of them, and it's not the only one.
Well, thank you so much for calling in. That was Mary Bonato, who is a nationally renowned litigator and civil rights project director at GLAAD and also a Mainer. Thanks so much, Mary, for calling in. I want to turn to you, Maren. Mary said you can't always prejudge things. Important perspective right now.
Absolutely. I thought that she put that very well, because there were some what we would call, quote unquote, surprises out of this term. And the LGBTQ and transgender rights case, that was Bostick v. Clayton, was one of them. And she mentioned that Chief Justice John Roberts and Neil Gorsuch joined the four liberal bloc. And so you had a 6-3 majority that protected gay and transgender workers under the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And that is something that, you know, I think a lot of pundits would have thought would go 5-4 in the conservative direction. She stated it very well, is that we cannot pre-predict the way that the justices will decide in future cases that haven't even happened. Certainly there are issue areas that we expect that future cases will arise, but you don't know what the particular legal provisions will be within those cases, and you don't know on top of that what will happen. There are just endless examples. You know, the 2012 ACA case where Chief Justice Roberts wrote and upheld the ACA case. You even have examples from history. Famously, former Chief Justice Rehnquist really, really disliked the Miranda rights, where Miranda rights being read out came from a prior Supreme Court case, and had stated publicly that if he ever got the chance on the Supreme Court to strike down Miranda, he would do so. He got that chance and then turned around and upheld Miranda rights, saying that we've progressed to a place in society where this is expected and it's knit into the fabric of our society and our legal system. So, yes, examples abound of the court and of individual justices doing things that weren't maybe expected of them. And so we shouldn't necessarily believe that, you know, all of these causes that Ruth Bader Ginsburg fought for are going to be lost causes.
And we have an email here from Karen. To be clear, Susan Collins said she would not vote for a Supreme Court justice before the election. She has not said if or how she would vote after the election. Jean, is that an important point to you?
Yes, all of these distinctions are important. And that's why I go back to my point. They said that some of the senators said we'll allow the vote, but they didn't say how they would vote. And there could be a surprise or two along the way. And I do think what Sue Collins implied is if Biden were to defeat Trump, then maybe she would call for a delay and allow Biden to fill the seat. If Trump's reelected, well, and the senator is reelected, well, then, you know, she may say, okay, fine, we could do it in the lame duck. So, you know, I mean, every twist and turn and every nuance is very important in terms of trying to figure out these tea leaves.
All right. So I'm going to go to Joy, who's calling from Bangor. Joy, go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Thank you. I was very disappointed in PBS. I was up late at night, and within hours after the judge's death, they were talking about her replacement and how they were going to vote. My thought is not political. My thought is, why can they not respect the dead and wait till the poor woman is cold in her grave and respect her wish we don't know, it wasn't a written wish, but her verbal wish that this not be done until after the election. I just think that it's a matter of respecting the dead, politics aside. And I did not give my real name because I am so sick of political calls on my phone. I do not answer my phone at this point in time because they are wasting our money calling us and sending the junk mail. Thank you for your time. And the previous caller, Mary, she was excellent. She talked about the issues, not who they were going to replace the judge with. Thank you for your time.
All right. Well, thank you, Joy, or pseudonym of Joy, calling from Bangor. And I will turn to you, Jean.
I really think she raises a valid point. The reason, of course, why the conversation shifted so quickly was, as Senator King said, 2 hours after the announcement that she had passed, McConnell was already talking about moving ahead in the Senate. So that did shift the conversation really fast. But I've been in Washington for a very long time. And there, you know, Washington, I feel like it never fails to disappoint, right? If there's a wrong or unseemly way to do things, this town often finds a way to go down that path. But I have to admit, I was surprised at how quickly it became partisan politics and not, you know, allowing 24 hours at least to recognize the incredible life that she led. I think, you know, D.C. did John McCain really well. They did John Lewis really well. And it would have been fabulous if they had done Ruth Bader Ginsburg as equal to those men.
We are going to take another quick break. We're talking about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, her legacy, and what comes next for the Supreme Court. If you'd like to call, the phone number 1-800-399-3566. If you're quick, you can send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Central Maine Power, committed to a clean energy future for Maine. Learn more at poweronmaine.com. And Breakwater, inviting you to learn more about their outdoor learning spaces and plans for the school year, school.breakwaterlearning.org.
The first Common Ground Country Fair was held at Litchfield on September 23, 1977. In 1981, it moved to Windsor, and in 1996, the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association purchased 200 acres in Unity, where the fair regularly takes place. The fair celebrates organic living, farming, and growing, and all the food sold at the event must be organic. MOFCA holds an annual competition for the artwork to be featured on the next year's fair poster. In 1987, the featured artwork was from Dolph Ipkar. The 2011 poster was a still-life oil painting of canned goods by Dacia Klinkirk. And the 2018 poster was a painting of two Kunikuni pigs by Erika Von Elder.
On This Day in Maine's History was created in partnership with the Maine Historical Society and made possible through the generous support of Bernstein Scher and Maine Masons, celebrating their bicentennial in Maine. Happy birthday, Maine! And coming up next at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio is Ideas from the CBC, The Seductive Lure of Authoritarianism. That's coming up later today at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. We are discussing the life of the late Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and what might be next for the nation's highest court. My guests are Jean Cummings with the Wall Street Journal and Maren Sorensen with Bowdoin College. Join our conversation by calling 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll go now to Larry calling from Bangor. Hi, Larry. Go ahead.
Hi. I just find it hard to express how much I respected and miss Ms. Ginsburg. And I have an equal amount of rage with Ms. Collins. She has voted for more than 200 judges slavishly proposed by Mitch McConnell, and more than a third of whom have been adjudged as unqualified for the city federal bench, and yet she just slavishly votes for whatever McConnell says. Now she's trying to placate people that are in the middle by saying she's not going to vote. I mean, she's already voted more than 200 times for extreme conservative judges.
Larry, thanks for your call. And Jean, almost as soon as Ruth Bader Ginsburg, as soon as her death, people started focusing on Susan Collins.
Well, Susan Collins and a half a dozen others. The truth is those senators who are facing challenging reelection campaigns, probably this makes life more complicated for about half of them, including Senator Collins, and it may be helpful for the other half, and that would be Tom Tillis in North Carolina, and surprisingly, Lindsey Graham himself seems to have a tight race going in South Carolina. The polls had shown that evangelicals, not a high percentage, but a percentage, a small percentage of evangelicals were actually starting to move away from the president. And any kind of softening among that base could be very threatening to the president because his margin of victory 4 years ago was so small. Now, though, things have become very complicated because, first of all, obviously, those voters who supported the president because the judges are now going to see, okay, the GOP is delivering. One question, though, is by voting before the election, does it take the issue off the table? And then the evangelicals or some may say, okay, mission accomplished, and they may not be as motivated to go out to vote. So there's a lot of tricky politics here, and it cuts so many different ways.
Maren, anything you want to follow up on?
The national electoral level politics aren't really my area of focus. But I'd reiterate some of the points that some of the callers have made about there being a sort of general lack of respect in all of this. I was absolutely surprised to see Senator McConnell's statement yet on Friday night that decisively that there would be a vote yet this year. Just watched as different senators have made public statements. And as Jean also pointed out, their public statements haven't been that they definitively will or won't vote for the nominee. You've just had Senator Collins and Murkowski come out with statements that they don't support doing this prior to the election. So this is another circumstance where I suppose we're going to have to wait and see what happens.
Let me ask you this, Maren. Does the court reflect the American public at all anymore?
The court is certainly more conservative than the public is. However, there was a really neat article published in the New York Times that went through all of the major cases of this last term and compared polled on those issues. And by and large, the court in this last term fell in line with opinion polling on those issues. And, a lot of court scholars think that this is being driven in part by Chief Justice Roberts. He is known to want to protect the institutional legitimacy of the court. And at a certain point, if the court is out of line, not just ideologically, but in its decisions with the public, that's when the court starts to become questioned. And that's actually the circumstances that we saw directly prior to FDR's court packing plan. You had a court that was conservative and it was striking down large pieces of FDR's New Deal legislation. And it was, tracking out of line with public opinion polling. And so luckily you had the infamous switch in time that saved nine. So you had one of the conservative justices began voting to uphold the legislation. But, we're approaching that same precipice with the way that the ideological median on the court is diverging from the sort of ideological median of the public.
Michael on Facebook writes, for the caller who asked, why can't we respect the dead and do it until after the election? Trump is saying that he needs to fill the vacancy immediately because he plans to fight mail-in ballots in the courts. quote, "We need 9 justices. You need that. With the unsolicited millions of ballots that they're sending, it's a scam. It's a hoax." Donald Trump. Jean?
Oh, absolutely. I'm so worried about how big the mess is going to be post-election, no matter how it turns out. I'm not a lawyer. I have heard legal scholars commenting on this scenario. Many of them suggested that the new justice should recuse herself, now that we know it's going to be a woman, in light of all of the circumstances. I believe that Trump feels like he needs to move quickly, not because of any particular case, but because he wants to deliver a promise. He wants to energize his base, and he wants to pocket the win before Election Day. So it's part of his legacy. I think that's his real motivation. That's why I was a little surprised if McConnell, usually his top priority is to save his majority, and forcing this vote actually threatens it more so than helps it. So I was surprised McConnell went along, but then you got to go way down into the weeds, there's a special election in Georgia and one in Arizona. And if the Democrats were to prevail there, then they might not be able to get the nominee through the lame duck session. So I think McConnell felt like he had to go now.
Mm. I want to ask you, Mayor. Go ahead.
So from a procedural standpoint, the court absolutely can hear cases with 8 members. There's nothing barring it from doing that. And in fact, it hears about 20% of its cases over time with 8 members, either because justices recuse themselves or because of sickness or illness or death, and a vacancy is there. So the court sort of has 2 mechanisms that it can use to avoid a 4-4 decision. Because if the court does render a 4-4 decision, the judgment below is affirmed, because they're not going to alter or overturn a judgment below in a case where it's 4-4, and no precedent is set. And so the court only actually renders a 4-4 decision over time in about 5% of the cases in which it hears a case with only 8 justices. And so you either just have the coalition works extra hard to avoid an equally divided outcome, or the other option is very simple. The court can vote to relist a case for a later time when there would be 9 justices. So President Trump isn't required in any way, shape, or form to appoint a 9th justice so that she is present for battles that happen after the election. The court has ways of ensuring that it settles, precedent, and it decides cases with 8 justices just fine.
Lawton in Penobscot says he has a question for Jean. Whether Ginsburg's death and this opening for Trump become a great diversion from the issues of COVID and health care during the campaign?
Well, they could be. They could be. You could, if you watch Biden in the last couple of days, he's avoiding the subject, or he was at least in those appearances. He's talking virus. And he, in the context of the Supreme Court, is talking about the Affordable Care Act. So it could be that we'll have these dueling messages where Trump only wants to talk about the appointment to the Supreme Court and Roe v. Wade, and Biden doesn't want to talk about it. And it makes some sense from Biden's perspective, because healthcare and the pandemic are stronger issues for him, and there is absolutely nothing he can do in terms of the fight over the Supreme Court. That battle belongs to Schumer and Pelosi, not Joe Biden.
An email here from Dre. Talking about Justice Ginsburg this week with my mom, 88 next week, is a deep feminine bonding experience for me. I feel my mother would have truly excelled in a field of her desire and could have contributed her innate talent at high levels had societal conditions been more inclusive to women. These things felt present in our conversation as we marveled at everything about Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Lovely sentiment. And Dre, thank you so much for writing that. And I want to ask you, Maren, because you teach young women, and I've seen some things on social media that suggest that women in their 20s don't view RBG necessarily the same way older women do.
There has been a small amount of backlash against this painting Justice Ginsburg as a feminist icon. And some of that is due to a few statements that she made. So she maybe famously made statements about Colin Kaepernick that weren't flattering. And she later apologized and sort of recanted and explained that she had learned a little bit more about Colin Kaepernick. But certainly there is a notion that, young people are looking for maybe a little bit more social action and activism on the ground level. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg was very much about, affecting change step by step through the legal process. You know, I can't say that I personally encounter that in my students. And I sort of frame for my students lessons that we can take from Ruth Bader Ginsburg are lessons about commitment to a cause, about working through unrelenting obstacles, working outrageously long hours when you have a sick husband and a small child, being precise in one's language and precise in one's ability to identify the issues that are present in an argument. And so I don't feel personally in my classes and with my students a pushback against her, but I do know that that's present kind of in social media and the Twitter sphere, yes.
Mm. And Jean, we just have a few seconds left. Anything you want to add about Ruth Bader Ginsburg?
I think for the young people and even for myself, her death serves as a reminder or a lesson for the young people about the extraordinary accomplishments that she achieved. And we really owe her such a debt because our lives were transformed by the work that she did.
Thank you so much. That voice, Jean Cummings, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for The Wall Street Journal. Also with us for the hour, Maren Sorensen, an Assistant Professor of Government at Bowdoin College. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Today's program will be rebroadcast at 7 this evening. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.